space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html. So, I posted a deal in the chat room over there. Question, why high voltage? Well, we're going to get into that today. I'm hoping that you'll understand what it is that I'm talking about by the time it's all said and done. We're also going to talk about the two most powerful and destructive forces on the earth, one being heat and the other being water. If you ever paid attention out there of what goes on with water and heat, there's two really powerful forces that at sometimes they become obnoxious. You don't want heat in your electronic circuit, so you got to figure out a way to get rid of that heat. You don't want heat coming from the form of friction and bearings, because once a material reaches its thermal breakdown, it will begin to fail. So heat in the process of a lot of things is a bad thing. Heat in electricity, according to the standard version of how you're actually using electricity, is a bad thing, with the exception of the point whenever you want to use electricity to produce heat. So, with that said, maybe it could be a case that we're actually trying to get heat the wrong way, as far as using a resistive load where you got to use a lot of current and amperage and stuff in order to be able to generate a lot of heat. So if you look at on the back of any of your space heaters, they usually deliver or drain a lot of wattage. They're anywhere from, I think, 500 watts, 750 watts, up to about 11 or 1250 watts, give or take whichever ones, model you got. Either way, they use a lot of electricity. And even in modern day heat pump systems, there's a secondary element that when it gets down below a certain temperature and the heat pump don't work like it normally would at certain temperatures, then there's a secondary element that kicks in, and when that thing kicks in, your electric meter will spin like a helicopter. Maybe like a hurricane or a tidal wave or a tornado, that's what I meant. Anyway, nonetheless, it's a huge resistive load that is draining a lot of power from the grid in order to produce heat using an electric element. And so, that's obviously not something you want if you're trying to save money on your electricity. And if you want to be able to be like more efficient, regardless of the money deal, then you want to try to figure out another way that you can actually generate heat without having to use a lot of power to do so. The second element I talked about, water. Water's hydrogen and oxygen separated. Both hydrogen and oxygen can be used as a fuel source. There's multiple uses for hydrogen and oxygen. And in its liquid state and pressurized, water can actually be used to cut through steel. There's actually a high-pressure saw out there that you can actually cut through all different types of materials using water, basically like nature does with erosion. You know, if you look out there at different canyons and stuff, that over the years that the rivers had flooded and washed away pieces of the ground or whatever, and basically cut through the rock. So there's two forces that are pretty powerful. Some that you don't want in certain circumstances, really destructive. The hydraulic pressure of water, basically able to, you know, wash things away, just erode everything. And so, but these two forces, these are two forces that we actually use on a regular basis. Everybody's got, everybody who lives in the, I guess you'd say the more advanced societies or more fortunate societies have running water. And that running water has to be at a certain pressure. I think it's somewhere about 60 PSI max for a lot of different uses, like your garden hose and such. You don't want too much pressure, because the couplings that we all put our pipes together with, whether it be PEX or PVC or even metal for that matter, have to be able to hold up to that type of pressure. Anyway, we use water for all kinds of stuff, mostly a life-giving source. But at the same sense, water is a really powerful and destructive molecule. It's actually one of the most stable molecules on the planet. And if you know what to do with water, you can use it for all kinds of stuff. Not just taking a bath or washing your hands or drinking or whatever, but it could also be used as fuel. That was proven way back when. They've been using water to boil water to basically expand it into steam to turn turbines for God knows how many years. Hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. They figured out by boiling water you get actual pressure out of that deal. So there's all kinds of different uses and ways that you can manipulate the water molecule to get it to do some work and such. And so here we are in the world of alternative energy, searching for the holy grail, which is free energy, trying to figure out a way to still be able to tap into that that notorious electricity and be able to run all the appliances that we have without basically having to pay the man. See, they built a hydroelectric dam, and all they had to do was maintain that hydroelectric dam, and they were essentially tapping into free energy on their side and then selling that free energy to you. And the other folks, researchers such as Tesla, decided, well, you know, we could if we could give the world free energy, there wouldn't be no reason for everybody to fight over resources and such. Of course, this battle moved on into the conspiracy world and such, where everybody, you know, thought that, well, free energy is not possible, and the laws of physics wrote everything down into stone, so to speak, so that everybody who was out there to look for free energy wouldn't be able to find it so easy. Because it's always said that there's certain things you can't do. You can't defy the laws of physics. Whatever. Anyway, there's so many different points I want to make on this subject. It just drives me bonkers to try to keep it all together. I posted a couple videos over there in the chat room. Easy high voltage power supply was the first one, and a flyback driver it was the second one. The second one I like is because it's really simple. It's only got two parts to it, and even the first one I like. I like them all, but nonetheless, down on the third video down shows you a basic simple three-part inverter to turn DC current into AC current using a, oh, doggone it, what do they call those doggone things? Ah, heck. Anyway, simple little part that basically turns the part which was usually used as a relay switch into an oscillator. And of course he says at the end of this video that it's not very practical because the moving parts in there will eventually fail because of friction and heat and all that kind of stuff. So while it does work, it wouldn't be the best go for the situation if you wanted to turn DC current into AC current. So all along, you know, according to science, energy can neither be created nor destroyed, which basically means you're not creating any energy and you're not destroying any energy. You're just moving it around from place to place, and we're trying to find more efficient and better ways to move that energy so that we can utilize it to, you know, do our heating and cooling and stuff. And so these three little videos that I first posted up in there are concepts that basically show you how high voltage is actually generated. The second one, being the simplest one, has a MOSFET in there, which is basically a really fast acting switch. And it has he shows how you take a flyback transformer, which you can find in just about any old TV set that basically are becoming extinct. Anyway, by pulsing a coil, the primary of a coil, rapidly, and depending on the number of turns you got on the other side, you can ramp the voltage and pressure up out of the other side in the secondary. And so, in this particular video, he has he has 12 windings around there and a center tap wire in the middle of it, and he's using a MOSFET as a really fast acting switch to pulse that new primary on there. I like this one here because these actual flyback transformers actually do have their own primary on there, but he's not even using it. He's just using the actual core to pulse that energy through to the secondary. So it's really super simple, really super easy, and he says it puts out somewhere around about 10,000 or more volts out the other side. Well, I've been talking a lot about Beckett oil burner igniters, but the problem that I have with Beckett oil burner igniters is that even though it says it's a constant duty igniter, they can get hot and burn up really easy. And so that's another thing about the heat. You got to be able to keep the heat away from certain components, otherwise they get hot and they burn up. And at $85 a pop for one of them Beckett oil burner igniters, unless you get lucky and find one for $30 at a flea market, then they're really hard to get. But these old flyback drivers, if you have access to an old TV or an old computer monitor or something like that, the ones with the big picture tube in them, you can reclaim these or salvage these to get high voltage. And, excuse me. I'm going to take a drink of my coffee. Anyway, so I'm trying not to bounce all over here, back and forth to different things, but I posted a link down there about magnetrons, how magnetrons work, microwave magnetrons, and I also posted a link underneath there for a cutaway view of a microwave magnetron. Why this is important is because you can actually generate a microwave with a microwave magnetron that will interact with a water molecule using the microwave. Since water is a dipole molecule, it has a positive and a negative on there, you're able to send a wave through there and rock those water molecules so rapidly that you in turn generate friction, which in turn generates heat and cooks your food in your microwave oven. And so using that knowledge, we know now another way that we can actually interact with water to generate heat. See, heat and water, hand in hand, if you, doggone it, if you look how dry air in here this morning, sorry about that. If you look how all steam generating power plants work, they basically got to use some sort of fuel to boil the water, turn it into steam, and then generate that, using that steam pressure to generate through turbines and turn a generator head to generate electricity. So if you can figure out a way to get heat to boil water into steam, then you can generate electricity just like the power plants do out there. Now, with the exception of the hydroelectrics, which basically uses water pressure to come down and turn turbines, which then in turn turns a generator head that will produce electricity that way. So either way, we're talking about the same thing. We're talking about pressure. Either water pressure, lots of volume behind that, going through a smaller entrance, produces a lot of pressure, and that high pressure has enough power to literally turn a turbine that in turn produces the electricity that you use. Steam generating power plants, nuclear power plants that are actually generating steam, same thing. You boil the water, it turns into steam, and the steam pressure builds up, and then it turns the turbines. So to find a more efficient way in order to utilize these forces is the key to the alternative energy research out there. See, a lot of people are trying to figure out ways around certain laws of physics and ways around different methods by which they could either make a solid state generator or a self-charging generator, some way or another that they can produce as much electricity as necessary on demand without having to go through the power company, essentially. Give everybody in the world free electricity. And electricity is free. It's the equipment to use that is the problem. See, when you buy a solar panel setup, then all you're doing is relying on the sun to produce your electricity for you. But nonetheless, once that solar panel setup is paid for, it's all free electricity from that point on. Just like the power company that has the hydroelectric dam. Now, the other lesser efficient ones would be the coal-fired power plants or the nuclear power plants where they have to continuously buy fuel and bring fuel in and stuff like that. The sun, on the other hand, and the hydroelectric dam basically relies on nature to produce the power necessary to generate the electricity. And so as far as efficiency wise, as far as free electricity, you got two examples of not free electricity and you got two examples of natural forces producing electricity. So the hydroelectric dam and the solar power industries and the wind power industries, those are all free electricity. And, you know, I don't want to sit around and argue with people and mince words, oh, it's not free energy, you got to pay this to get that or whatever, the equipment costs. Sure, the equipment costs, but don't get me wrong here. Once that equipment's paid for, it's free electricity, plain and simple. The person that owns the equipment then can in turn put a meter on it and sell you that energy. Once you understand how the energy is actually generated to begin with, then you can work on a device to actually generate your own power. And the whole key is everybody looking for free electricity are missing the basics, the simples of everything. And that's why the alternative energy community is in the state that it is right now. You know, people arguing over who's right and who's wrong, which device is the best and all that kind of stuff. I'm not here to argue over any of these devices. Some of them have their good qualities and some of them are just flat out junk. And there's some out there that are just flat out hoaxes. Not going to point fingers or get any names going on again, but nonetheless... Once you understand how electricity works, we produce an artificial magnetic field using some sort of power source. And basically, by how fast you pulse that, will determine on the hertz range, 50 to 60 or higher hertz is basically standard. Yeah, 50 hertz overseas, 60 hertz over here in the States, and so that's about what all of the rest of the energy that we have, or that the appliances that we have basically use 50 to 60 hertz range of pulsed AC current. Then we have some DC appliances or whatever. It's just the only difference between the AC and DC is the oscillation, the pulsing of it, turn the switch off and on, or whatever. It's not rocket science. It's basically simple. You're either getting a smooth flow of electrons or you're getting an intermittent flow of electrons. That's it. It's that simple. And so, in order to be able to run everything that we run, our doggone computers and electric motors and all that kind of stuff, in the process of running electricity, if you've got a resistive load, you're going to generate heat. So they basically developed electric heaters that use electric element, tungsten elements, or different types of bulbs with tungsten elements inside there that use the pressure, the resistive load, or the frequency range of the voltage coming through there to either vibrate the element to the extent that it basically generates heat, or the resistance of the amount of energy that you're forcing through a specific material does the same exact thing. It's all vibrating. You know, you're trying to force a lot of wattage through a wire, a lot of amperage or whatever, and it will cause that material to get hot. And in some instances, The heat is your worst enemy. Because the hotter it gets, the less efficient it gets, or the hotter it gets, the more likelihood that it's going to either burn through the insulation or burn the wire in half and fail. So, why is it I'm so in the high voltage? Well, first off, getting energy from one place to the next is easy. But getting the energy from one place to the next in the most efficient and the fastest manner is where you're going to get it with the high voltage. Now, it's obvious you can't run a lot of appliances these days, especially your computer, on really high voltage. But we're only talking about transferring energy from one form to the next. We already figured out we can take AC current and we can rectify it and make DC current, or we can take DC current and oscillate it and get AC current. So all we're doing it with either one, whichever one we need, is we're basically just changing the delivery system on how it is that we actually use this energy. Now, with really heavy resistive or large loads, every single generator does exactly the same thing, whether it's an AC generator or a DC generator. Doesn't matter. They all do the exact same thing, and that is when you put a load on a generator, Lenz's law kicks in, and eddy currents and stuff like that happen that now are causing that generator head to work harder, get hotter, and at some point will fail. So the key is your generating source needs to never have to work hard. If the generating source is working hard, then there is a thermal breakdown in there. There's a sweet spot in every single generator. If you look on the tags of every single generator, it will tell you a peak voltage, and it'll tell you a normal operating voltage, the best recommended voltages and currents and everything that you can get out of this generator to where it's working its most efficient. First off, the internal combustion engine on any generator like that, or even the coal-fired power plants, or even the nuclear power plants, already running inefficiently because of the amount of fuel that they have to use and the way that they're using the fuel. So what I'm suggesting is basically a rethink of how we actually use the energy to begin with. Whatever we're going to use for fuel, that we use it more efficiently so that it's you get more for your money, so to speak. With nuclear power, there's a lot of concerns as far as waste materials that are generated because of the materials that are actually used for fuel. There's many concerns about possibilities of accidents and such like that. Even with coal-fired power plants, there's concerns about too much carbon getting in the air. There's concerns about potentials of, fire or explosion or whatever. You know, all of those, when you're messing around with energy, are potentials. They're possibilities. And so, if you could find a cleaner and more efficient way to generate heat to boil water, then you would basically take away from the equation any radioactive component or any type of toxic waste that could be generated. All you're doing is using physics and a couple different elements in order to do what was done before using fuel, what they classify as fossil fuels in some cases, nuclear fuel in other cases. Now, the hydroelectric generators, perfect scenario, that's it. You know, you're not having to put any fuel to that generator in order to produce that electricity. Well, the folks that own the hydroelectric dams, they're basically selling you free electricity. It's as simple as that. Now, sure, they got to maintain them. They got to They got to keep an eye on them. They got to make sure that there's not too much pressure behind the dam, or that they maintain the dam so the dam don't break and all that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, you can learn a lot from them because they've literally tapped into nature and they're using that to generate power. Solar power, same thing. And wind power, same thing. So there's three possibilities right there that can generate electricity for free from nature. If you look into thermal electricity, there's also another right there where they literally, in some cases, drill down into the earth to find a spot where it's hot, and then they use that heat transfer system to turn that heat into electricity. So what everybody's wanting is essentially that, electricity, so that they can run their fans and their air conditioners and everything else, the TVs and the computers and all that kind of stuff. And the only argument we have is how we're going to get this electricity and protect the environment at the same time. How we're not going to destroy the earth in the process of trying to generate electricity. How we're not going to pollute the waterways and stuff like that. So for your average Joe during an apocalyptic scenario and the power grid goes down, we always hear about what happens if the power grid goes down. How am I going to keep my freezers going? And how am I going to keep all the lights on and the heater and all that going on? That's why people should be supporting their alternative energy researchers. Different methods by which to do the same doggone work. With high voltage, you don't have high current initially. And so you can't run your normal appliances with it. All high voltage is for is to literally move energy from one place to the next fast. And under a frequency range that, instead of using resistance to, let's say, vibrate a tungsten element, you use a high frequency to vibrate that tungsten element. I did a video quite some time back called Vacuum Spark Gap, and in which, and I've talked about it on the Mad Science Show a few times, where I had 12 volt headlamp out of a out of an automobile that the tungsten element inside there was burnt in half. So if you hook this to a regular car battery, it would not light up. It because the element, the circuit was broke, it wouldn't light up. But with the high frequency that I was sending in through this bulb, I was using the bulb as a spark gap. The high frequency was literally able to jump across that break in the circuit and still be able to vibrate the tungsten element and cause it to light up. So here's a light bulb that by modern definitions would be trash. You throw it in trash. It's no good. You can't use it to light your headlight anymore. And if somebody really wanted to be ingenuitive or whatever, make a little bit of money, you could actually develop a high voltage backup system for when your headlamp and your car was to blow out, that it would switch over to a separate type of power supply where suddenly now you're running that instead of off of current watts and amps, you're running off a high voltage, high frequency. And there'd be a couple things that you have to work out. Obviously, you wouldn't want that feeding back through the same wiring system and such, but nonetheless, if it was done properly, you wouldn't even know it ever even happened. You wouldn't even know your headlamp ever went out other than when it... heck, I don't even know how you'd know. Basically, your headlamp would stay working as long as the power supply for the high voltage portion was working, right? And so how do we generate that high voltage? Well, by oscillating any coil wire. If you look at the modern day magnetic ballast. It used to be that they had a primary and a secondary coil on them. And now they only have one coil. And they use basically the same process that a starter generator, which I also posted a link over there. It says HTTP www.flightmechanic.com, electrical starting systems and starter generator starting systems. Anyway, that same process where they use the starter generator is the same process that those magnetic ballasts use. When you pulse that, it produces a field around that ballast. And it is when you let off of that the field collapses and sends energy back out the other way. And so with a starter generator, when you use, like on a tractor, you put voltage to the starter, and it turns the flywheel, which in turn produces the compression inside the pistons, and then your ignition system sends a spark down into the cylinders and ignites your fuel, or depending on whether you're running gasoline or diesel, because diesels basically use compression ignition. Once the cylinder gets hot in a diesel, then that is replacing the spark plug. Anyway, nonetheless, you put power to the starter, it turns the deal over, gets it started, and then when the engine starts to run, the RPMs will kick up, and now the starter itself becomes your generator for your vehicle to charge your battery and use your electrical system. So the magnetic ballast and the starter generator has something in common in the sense that they're each being used backwards from what, instead of on the magnetic ballast systems, you put a pulse to it. When that flyback comes off of that pulse, it sets out a really high voltage out the other end, and then you rectify that energy and use it to DC, or you can actually use it for AC as well. All these concepts are just how you're actually fluctuating the power, switching it on and off, whether or not you're going to allow a direct electron flow, or you're going to be pulsing the electrons out the other side, determine whether you're going to have AC or DC. It's so ridiculously simple, it's mind-blowing. It's not rocket science. Now, this one particular flyback driver that Ludic Science showed how to make, it's really impressive because it's really super simple. And it uses the equivalents of a MOSFET, or you could actually use a transistor or anything, any fast acting switch. You could actually build a rotary switch as well, just like the starter generator. When you put power one way, it turns it to turn the gear that turns the motor to get the engine started. And then as it's going back, it uses the same exact system in reverse that produces high voltage pulses. And so you could build a rotary spark gap, or you could build a rotary switch that would, as the electric motor turned, you turn the potentiometer or variac or whatever to adjust your power to this thing, it would spin it up, and on the flyback of the when the coils are pulsing, being switched on and off, that flyback energy can now be gathered back up and turn it into a generating system. I hope some of that made sense. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. It's really simple concepts. Check out starter generators. Check out rotary spark gaps and rotary. I don't know if they even make any rotary switches, but essentially, an electric motor being spun backwards that has brushes on there would be the equivalent of a rotary switch. It would be the magnetic field pulsing the coils, and as the brushes are hitting the little notches in there that are making and breaking contact out the other side of that, that's how you're actually getting an AC current out there that you then in turn rectify and produce electricity that way. So a generator of any type, generating head of any type that produces AC current is already a rotary switch. If you put power to it, be it like turning the shaft, and you spin this thing up, or you even put electric motor on the end of it and you spin this thing up, it's turning the switch on and off, on and off, on and off, producing AC current. If you have an electric motor on the other side, you can actually adjust the frequency, not electric motor, a potentiometer or a variac that actually decreases or increases the input power. You can actually change the frequency of the output just by speeding it up and slowing it down. So you can adjust it up to 60, 50 hertz or 60 hertz or even higher by spinning this thing really super fast. And the faster you spin it, the higher the voltage will go. So the key of what I'm talking about is I want that frequency up there really high, because the faster that energy is coming out, I'm not going to be putting that energy under a direct load. I'm not going to be utilizing this energy like the standard model of when you plug your generator, you start your generator, you plug your light bulb in it, and the energy from the generator head goes into the light bulb and then back into the doggone generator again. I don't want that to happen, because that's where the problems begin, is because now you're actually generating the lens effect, and you're actually generating eddy currents that in turn produce heat, which in turn at some point will cause the thing to fail. I just want that energy I want the same energy that came off of that generator, but I don't want all the bad portions of it until I'm ready for them. I want to guide that energy to where I want it to go. I want that energy to do what I want it to do. I don't want it to do anything more than produce a high frequency at this point. And I don't want to put that generator under any undue stress. I want to send this energy into a completely different state of matter, such as plasma, or take this energy and utilize the high voltage to actually do what it would naturally do that you don't want to happen. I want it to be able to generate heat. So I'm going to turn my generator into a heater. And then I'm going to use the forces that water has capable. I can either use the high frequency to separate the water molecules and utilize that separation for fuel to actually run the initial generator itself. Or I can use the heat that is generated from the high frequency to transfer that heat into the water, to energize that water into steam, and then use steam pressure to do the rest of the work. So it's all about how you're actually going to move this energy around. What am I going to do with the energy once I get it produced? There's all types of storage capability. And I say crazy stuff like, well, you could run an entire house off of a 2,500 watt generator. People do the math and they're saying, no, you can't. There ain't no way that you could run a house off of a 2,500 watt generator. Well, directly you're right. You could not run it directly because you're drawing too much amperage, you're drawing too much wattage, you got an energy hog that you're trying to use this energy for. But think about this for a second. And I proved this in a video. One called 9 Volt, I believe it was, and another one called Unsubscribe, where I showed a system that basically you took energy and use it more efficiently by storing the energy before you ever did anything with it. So if you got an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and you have a means by which you can keep filling this Olympic-sized swimming pool, and then you have a smaller pool, and then a smaller one all the way down to a bucket, and then eventually down into just a little glass or a cup. As long as you can keep that Olympic-sized swimming pool full, then all the other systems down there, all the other power banks, battery banks, whatever you want to call them, are full, and they will be able to run those loads continuously on demand without any problem, as long as the pressure above is higher than all the pressures necessary to run the loads below. So I showed this in a video called Unsubscribe, because I was getting pretty frustrated from all the craziness going on. Anyway, so you take that 2,500 watt generator and you turn that 2,500 watt generator into a charging system for a power bank. Now, depending on the size of your power bank, how many batteries or capacitors that you use to storage, whatever method that you want to use to store this energy, you may have to start off a day ahead of time and start charging your system up. Once your system gets up to past what its operating necessities are, its needs, everything after that is backup. It's basically the equivalence of the difference between having one 12-volt battery or two 12-volt batteries as your power bank. It takes a lot longer to drain that system down the more batteries you add to it. Look at how solar panels work. You got a large battery bank. Solar panels during the daytime are charging up the battery bank, and then you're running at nighttime using AC inverters, or even if in some instances you're using direct DC to run whatever it is that you want to run. So half the day you're out in the sunlight, the rest of the day you're running off a reserve in those power banks. And depending on the size of the power banks will determine on how long you can actually run once the initial power input stops. That's the key. A larger battery bank will going to obviously buy you more time that you can run. Once it's fully charged up, this is more time that you can run. Now, at what point when you have the power input, you got the whole entire bank, the Olympic size swimming pool full, and all the other smaller ones down below it are filled up, all you have to do is ensure that that Olympic size swimming pool never goes dry. You're putting energy in from the wind, you're putting energy in from the sun, you're putting energy in from thermal, you're putting energy in from hydroelectrics, Wherever you tap in what nature's already done. And so you got now a battery bank that will last past the entire night. So if you got enough energy stored in there that you can utilize that energy halfway into the next day, or you got a large enough battery bank that you can use it all the way up to maybe you run your solar panels for one day, run off the energy for 2 days when the sun ain't out, and so on. Check it out. See when's the longest time anybody's ever ran off of stored energy from solar panels. Because when they charge their battery banks up, if they got a large enough battery bank, they can go for a day or 2 days or longer on the reserve that they just had stored. So the same concept could be done with a 2,500 watt generator. If you had a 2,500 watt generator, you'd run it long enough to charge your battery banks up, your storage tanks, or whatever it is that you're going to, your type of energy you're going to use. And that doesn't exclude compressed air or anything like that. There's all kinds of different possibilities. You just have to take the ones that are most efficient. But for now, we're just talking about batteries, electricity, or whatever. You take a 2,500 watt generator, you're charging up your battery bank and running off of the energy from the batteries. And so at certain points when the battery bank's full, you're not running your generator to charge it. It shuts itself off. So, utilizing everything we know about storage of power, you can run your house off of a 2,500 watt generator if you have a storage facility able to save back that energy. Basically, all you're doing is building up pressure in all these different batteries and utilizing that pressure with the equivalence of a smaller load, because you have more energy potential in all these batteries than's necessary to run your house. Now, would it take quite a few batteries? Sure, and it'd probably be expensive as all get out. Now, if you utilize knowledge from capacitors, you could build your own capacitors fairly cheap. Aluminum foil and glass, you got a capacitor. And so you got a negative plate, you got a positive plate, you can store energy on those plates. Nature will try to balance itself back out and equalize those plates, and that's where you actually get your current flow. You can take a capacitor, any electrolytic capacitor or any type of capacitor you got, you charge this thing up. If it's already connected to a load when you charge it, when you take the power input off, it will utilize that energy just like a battery, because that, like, let's say for example the LED in between there is a resistive load. It's going to resist that flow of electron from one plate to the next, and so as it balances out, it slowly discharges as opposed to instantaneously discharge if you put a dead short to it. Some folks figured it out and they made the shake-up flashlight. If you ever seen one of these doggone flashlights, it's got a magnet inside there, it's got a coil inside there, it's got a little circuit with a capacitor and a little rechargeable. Some of them have rechargeable batteries, some of them don't, but this one here that's in my hand is just a super capacitor. There are no batteries in there that I can see. And you shake it, you produce AC current that goes through a rectifier that in turn charges up the capacitor, and they call it the forever flashlight. So you're just using that same bit of knowledge in order to be able to have a flashlight with no batteries involved. It's all about storing pressure. And so I want to, what's all this got to do with high voltage is that you can charge capacitors rapidly with high voltage. Charging a capacitor is like blowing up a balloon. You're pressurizing it. That's all you're doing. And even when you charge your car batteries, all you're doing is pressurizing it. You're throwing the plates off of balance, and you're producing pressure inside there. And that pressure is what actually gets the work done. Now sure, an average generator running the average load, you got to have a lot of current, you got to have a lot of watts and amperage in order to be able to keep up with everything that is being demanded of that generator. But there are so many inefficiencies in the appliances that we have today that it's ridiculous. So you got to figure out a way to try to get around all that and do it in the most efficient manner possible. The best way to do it, to even get close to that, is to figure out the storage facility that you want to store that pressure until you get ready to use it. I did a video called Physics Toy, wherein it had a balloon inside of a container. And you could blow up the balloon and then snap the lid shut, and it would hold that pressure inside that for however long until you open that lid, and then nature had a path to balance that energy back out, then the balloon would go flat. It's no different than what you're doing with a battery or a capacitor. So if you find a way to store energy, we know that we can store air pressure, we can store heat, We can store static electricity. We can store DC, AC. It doesn't matter. Any energy out there can be stored in the form of pressure. So with high voltage, it'd be the equivalence of one man's junk is another man's treasure. High voltage will fry your computer, because it's not designed to run off a high voltage. And in the process of actually running your computer, in certain parts of the circuit, you actually do have high voltage in there. You got fast-acting transistors and MOSFETs and stuff like that inside different electronics that are turning things on and turning them off rapidly. This sudden surge of power, or even the resistance of the power waiting behind in order to force the pressure through the transistor or the MOSFET, caused the transistor or the MOSFET to get hot. There's the key. That resistance produces heat. And you have to have what they call a heat sink on the back of the transistors, on the back of the MOSFETs, because of the resistance that it's fighting against, because of the energy flow that's going through there, it's producing heat. And so you got to figure out a way to get rid of that heat, otherwise you will watch your computer start smoking and burn up, because there's a lot of heat coming through there. Matter of fact, during the winter time, whenever I'm running all these computers to do this radio show, this pretty much is my heater. Because of the fans that blow the heat off of the circuit boards, it gets pretty warm up in here. Just with the doggone heaters and the heat transfer in the computers alone. So instead of having to actually run a heater, I just could use these doggone computers to do the work. So now that you know that these computers are producing heat, there's another heat source right there. And high voltage, because of its frequency, isn't causing a resistance. It's causing a vibration that is producing friction, which in turn is producing heat. That's basically back to the vacuum spark gap that I talked about, how it was, because of the frequency range, it was able to literally leap across that gap and still vibrate that tungsten element, energizing the halogen inside the bulb and basically lighting that doggone thing up. And then even after you shut it off, you put your hand over on the glass of that bulb and you can see that the glass of that bulb is hot, just like it was prior when it was running normally, when the element was still good. So I also posted down there a cutaway of a magnetron, microwave magnetron. I've seen a couple different versions of this doggone thing. Let me click on that link. This is a small picture, so you probably have to use your deal to zoom in on it. But basically, it shows a cutaway view of a microwave magnetron, how the actual magnetron is producing a microwave. You have an element that is basically a heater inside the vacuum of the magnetron itself. And the heater, when you put power to it, Your microwave oven will start off at 120 volts or 220 volts AC, depending on where you're at and what type you're using, will cause a heating element inside inside the magnetron to heat up and release heat inside there, release electrons inside there. You have a magnet on one side and a magnet on the other side that actually produce an effect that causes the electrons to begin to spin inside there while they're trying to find their way around wherever they're going. And then you have one on the opposite side that actually helps to guide it out of an antenna and then produce a little microwave radiation or whatever out the other side. Yeah, also in the same deal, there are cavities inside the deal where the electrons, when they get to spinning, they get trapped up in there and they get to spinning even faster, and then the magnets guide it through to the antenna, which sends it out into your microwave. And you have cooling fins on the outside because obviously the heater going on inside is transferring that heat inside there that is got to, you got to get rid of it. Basically what you're looking at right there is a light bulb. That's it. Now, I tried to take 6 amps and even 10 amps and higher to try to burn one of these things out so that I could actually use a magnetron as a spark gap and be able to get a doggone microwave out the other end just by putting high voltage from a 12-volt battery to a Beckett oil burner igniter that produces 10,000 per leg or 20,000 with both legs, 20,000 volts. So, trying to energize this and get this magnetron to produce a microwave using a 12-volt battery, an oil burner igniter, and the high voltage, high frequency jumping across the spark gap. See, the problem that I found is that the spark, because I have no way to get inside of this magnetron to modify it, to actually turn the inside of that magnetron into a spark gap, is that the spark itself was on the outside, which kept the heat, the plasma, and the energy that I wanted inside the vacuum was on the outside. But nonetheless, it produced enough heat that when I shut it off and went to touch the doggone spark gap, I put a blister on two of my fingers. That's how hot it got. That jumping across, it was actually connected to the earth ground, and it was connected to one leg per magnetron. One magnetron was connected to one leg, and the other one was connected to the other leg, and then both of the magnetrons were connected to the earth ground, which produced a lot of energy and a lot of heat. If you could modify or even build one of these specifically to act as a spark gap inside that vacuum, you would generate heat, which in turn would produce electron flow inside that vacuum and produce the microwave effect that you want out the antenna out the other side. There are some magnetrons out there, but I just haven't figured out which ones that actually have a wire type tungsten element inside there, and some of them have a cathode that is basically like the equivalent of a glow plug of a diesel engine. That's not what I want. I don't want to have that particular type deal because that's going to take more amperage, more wattage in order to be able to run that. What I want is one that is the equivalent of a spark gap inside there so that I can have that high voltage, high frequency inside the deal to keep the heat inside. Now when I hooked this up to 6 amps, it literally glowed like a light bulb because essentially that's what it is. It's a light bulb. And I just couldn't get that element to burn out. As hard as I tried, I couldn't get it to burn out. And even tried to connect the ground to the body and connect both of the wires to the inside of their actual input of the magnetron and tried to use the body as a spark gap between the power input on the other side. Nonetheless, wasn't successful. Need to be able to keep the spark gap inside that vacuum to run that magnetron. But the thing is, if somebody had the capability of designing a magnetron that had a spark gap inside there, you would have a low energy magnetron that could literally produce a microwave. And once again, you're not doing nothing fancy, and it only took high voltage to do it. If you look at how the actual microwave magnetrons work, how they just watch how the microwave oven works, period. What the heck am I running into over here? Watch it. Study how the microwave oven functions from start to finish. See how the energy is traveling, how it's being transferred from the primary, in the older styles, in the primary coil to the secondary coil, ramping the voltage up to, I think they said they were about 2,000 volts or higher in a microwave oven transformer. I'll have to double check on that. But nonetheless, 2,000 volts and higher in the secondary that then in turn goes in through the element inside the magnetron, produces heat, which releases electrons, which gets to spinning really fast and produces a microwave out the other end. If you could solve the problem, instead of using that energy like you're using it now, put a spark gap inside there so that that high frequency that you're generating will leap across the gap and produce the heat necessary to produce the microwave, then you'd have the most efficient magnetron in existence. All you need inside that magnetron is the heat to release electrons. High voltage will produce that heat. The plasma water heater that I've been working on, the only problem that I've been having with that is the argon and the sealing and getting this thing manufactured so that it doesn't leak. I don't need the argon. I don't even need the plasma reactor. You can test this theory by taking two copper coils and pumping water through there and then generating a high voltage and using those two copper coils as a spark gap. All I want to be able to do is transfer the heat from that spark gap into the water and then do whatever I do with the water from that point. So, even without the plasma reactor version that I'm trying to build, where I'm actually using the plasma to evenly disperse this heat over the copper wire or over the copper coils inside the chamber, even without that, just a high voltage arc going across these two copper coils will transfer that heat to the water. If you've seen my video, Redneck Hot Tub, you see that I got a coffee pot element. And for the price of a coffee pot, I can heat that water so hot that you can't get in it. It's too hot. It's too hot to sit in. It'll kill you. You'll overheat and die. And once that thing is up to temperature, there was no insulation under the hot tub, and it had open atmosphere above the hot tub, and I was able to sit in that thing in my shorts in the dead of winter when there was snow on the ground. Now, what's that tell you? Once you get that temperature up, it takes hardly anything to maintain it. Whereas it took a longer time to get from cold to normal operating temperature. Once I got it to operating temperature, all I had to do was continue to keep the process going, to continue to feed that energy into that hot tub. And in the dead of winter, with a coffee pot element, I was able to keep that water warm enough for me to sit in it. And that's pretty impressive. So, because I'm cold-blooded for one. So if you take that example, and if you can understand what it is that I'm trying to point out with the high voltage, high frequency, High voltage will burn through insulation and wire. I've gotten, and even Tesla got a lot of crazy high voltage burns because there's a lot of power in high voltage. If you talk to Ryan Abrams from Abrams Lab, him and Terry Woodruff, they always working on Slayer exciter circuits, using transistors and coil systems and producing high frequency that they're trying to do wireless energy transfer with. But nonetheless, they'll tell you the same thing. There's a lot of heat going on in there. You get a lot of weird burns from that high voltage. So if you can guide that energy, which would be the equivalence of, instead of AC current or DC current, just a higher frequency version of either or, it's all the same energy. It's just how you're going to be utilizing it. And it's so super simple to produce high voltage. And you're not going to be using this energy, like I said, from the generator in the same fashion that you've been using it all along. So if you want to generate the heat, I showed you the spark gap system. I just explained it to you, and that's actually in a video. Plasma water heater is what I'm calling it for the time being, because it has a lot more capabilities, but nonetheless, seeing is believing. And so what I need to do is I need to make another video with just an open air spark gap using copper tubing and show you that you can heat that water. Once you get that container up to its operating temperature, it will not take anything to maintain it. Just keep that thing going. That's it. So a low input, a high output of voltage. We're not talking about a lot of current, watts, and amps that gets all the riots started. We're talking about utilizing what would have normally been trash energy. I call it trash energy because you don't want the heat in certain circumstances because it tears up parts. It burns transistors up. When the Beckett oil burner igniter failed, it was due to heat. The way that they pack these Beckett oil burner igniters, is they don't want you to know what the internals are. So they put it in a black epoxy, which is one deal that insulates that heat to those parts, which keeps them from being able to get cool enough where you could be able to run this thing for days at a time if it were not for that crud that they put over there to hide the parts inside. They don't want you reverse engineering this for a lesser price so they can sell you these things for $85 when it probably only has a couple dollars worth of parts in the doggone thing. Transistors or MOSFETs and some coils. That's it. It's just it takes the 12 volt DC input, switches it off and on really fast, sends that energy in through the equivalence of a flyback transformer and causes that voltage to ramp pressure up and sends out a high voltage arc that in turn, when you spray your oil into your oil burner, it catches it on fire instantaneously and gets it burning. And these are called constant duty, but some of them don't even have to run constantly because all you needed it for was the initial startup and then the temperature of the actual internals of the oil burner itself was enough for combustion as soon as the oil came in from that point on. So if you could design the equivalence of a Beckett oil burner igniter that would produce you 20,000 volts and not allow it to get hot enough to where the material of the transistor or the MOSFETs, whichever ones they're using inside, do not reach their thermal breakdown, this device would never fail. if you could utilize what some of the gamers have utilized and some of the computer techs have utilized, to where you literally take a supercomputer that you built at home and you have a water-cooled system that is cooling down all the circuitry, the transistors, the resistors, the MOSFETs. It's basically taking the heat away from that system. Now you just took what was normally a supercomputer and turned it into a water heater as well, because you just took that energy that would have been wasted and it eventually would have caused your parts to fail, and you moved that energy away from it, and now you have energy that with the potential of storage. You could use your computer set up like that with a water-cooled system on it to literally heat your hot tub. Once you got the doggone, you know the thermal breakdown of any material, you know how far that you can go with that, how hot you can allow it to go before it finally fails. If the thermal breakdown is above 212 degrees, you know you can boil water with it. If the thermal breakdown is only 160 degrees before the part fails, you know you can heat water with it. So you'd be able to take what would have normally been an obnoxious, destructive force, such as heat, in your computer, and utilize it to heat your water, or even generate steam. It's just moving energy from one point to the next. In your plasma screens and your different types of computer monitors, there are high voltage power sources that are doing a lot of different cool stuff. And if you put your hand, you back your hand up against your monitor, even if it's a flat screen, you're going to find that there's heat being generated. Science says light is heat and heat is light, vice versa. And so, what can we do with the heat? Well, we can take the second destructive molecule, most powerful force, water, and we can either utilize the heat to keep pressurizing this water until it flashes into steam, or we can use the higher frequency to literally separate the hydrogen and oxygen bond and produce two separate types of fuel. You can take that heat, because we know about thermoelectrics, where you take a temperature difference on one side of an element and a temperature difference on the other side, and you actually produce an electrical current. In thermoelectrics, you basically take two dissimilar elements and you put heat to one side, and as long as the temperature of the element doesn't get too high and stops the process, then you have electrical flow. So, all you're doing, it's moving energy from one place to the next and changing the energy from one type to another. Essentially, it's all the same energy, just being utilized in a different fashion. Basically a man-made magnetic field. I say man-made because you pulse in a coil with a power supply. You're turning it on, turning it off, and you're producing that field. The faster you do it, the higher the frequency range of it up. The frequency is essentially how fast something is occurring. You know, obviously, the slower you do it, the lower the frequency. The faster you do it, the higher the frequency of that magnetic field being fluctuated, expanding and collapsing. And if you can put it on there super fast and ramp that voltage up, you can get ridiculously high voltages rapidly. Really simple. So what I was talking about by a rotary switch would be basically a mechanical version of a transistor. A transistor uses breakover voltage where, like, if you, and that might not even be the right terminology, when the voltage gets to a certain extent, then it will allow current to flow across to the other side, and then, in turn, turn the switch on. And so, it's using basically solid state to do that. A material that becomes either more conductive at a certain temperature or more conductive at a certain voltage. Nonetheless, transistors, when they're running, get hot. And you have to get rid of that heat via heat sink or some sort of water-cooled system. But those transistors, if used properly, and you know exactly when the thermal breakdown point is going to be, you could literally build a transistor-based heating system that you, all you're doing is using the transistor itself to generate heat. That's it. And then you're going to transfer that heat through to a liquid. And then you're going to turn around and use the high voltage generated by utilizing the doggone transistors to begin with from the rapid switching of it to generate high voltage that you can in turn add to the system and generate yet even more heat. You would be able to utilize transistors. All you're going to do is switch them off and on, off and on, off and on, off and on, off and on. And then on the opposite side of it, you have some sort of magnetic ballast that is going to grab that energy, cause a little bit of resistance to feed back to those transistors, and actually be able to pull high voltage off to the other side. You would have a solid state switching system utilizing transistors to generate heat. There are so many different potential ways to utilize energy, it is mind-blowing. So, if there's a way, and I've been trying this forever and a day, and I haven't been able to be very successful, to find the dream team. Somebody who just want to build stuff. Somebody who ain't going to want to argue about current watts and amps, who ain't going to want to argue about the laws of physics. We know what the laws of physics are. We know what they state. And we know that we want to invoke some and not invoke the others. We want to be able to build the most efficient system in the history of time. I'm saying that there's multiple different ways in which we can do this. There's multiple different methods. All we're going to do is take all these forces of nature that we already know about and build a power supply that is capable of heating people's houses, cooling people's houses, giving them light. For example, let's say you want to do this on a smaller scale. And this would be a perfect video for somebody out there who's got the engineering skills to actually tinker around with a MOSFET and a transistor. MOSFETs, transistors, LEDs. I'm going to put this idea out there on a table in hopes that somebody at least attempts it. If you get on eBay, you can buy water-cooled heat sinks. You actually sell little radiators that you can buy on eBay that will basically act like the radiator in your car. You'll need a tank sort of like the ones that I had in the water heater one, the plasma water heater. Build your homemade tank out of a jug or whatever. You don't need an electric pump. So essentially, you're going to hook a tank to a water-cooled doggone it, heat sink. And if you want, put the radiator in between there, so that when the transistor is switching on and off, and generating its heat, you're going to use the back of that transistor to heat water. When the water temperature begins to change, heat rises, so that water will go into the bottom of a otherwise cold tank of water, and that energy will rise to the top, which will produce a thermal siphon. The nuclear power plants over there in Japan use a backup thermal siphon that basically uses heat to, instead of an electric water pump, to move water. So while this transistor switching on and off, on and off, on and off, you have this transistor output going to a the equivalence of a Slayer exciter circuit. And that's producing wireless energy. With the wireless energy, you can light up LED lighting, or you could light up fluorescent lighting. And so on a small scale, you could actually produce a proof of concept that would show how you could actually build a high voltage generating system that would give you... See, the lighting portion, that's already solved. With LED technology and even fluorescent bulb technology, all you need is a high voltage, high frequency wave to energize that gas into the fourth state of matter, being plasma, which then in turn the energy produced by that is causing phosphorescence inside of a bulb to glow and give you visible light. So you'd be able to use transistors to generate heat, to generate high voltage, to give you heat and light both. And you can do it on a small scale that will show you what it is that I've been talking about. It's a real simple concept, and all the parts are readily available. Heck, you could even scavenge parts out of stuff. As one video, he shows how to make a high voltage power supply that you have to plug into AC. That basically the circuit came out of a CFL bulb. The energy saver bulbs. The circuit's already made for you to produce the high voltage. And down at the bottom, that other video down there showed how to make an inverter. So you could actually either do it with a relay, or you could do it with a tattoo gun. Anything that turns the power off and on to that coil will produce an AC current that in turn will drive the circuit that gives you the high voltage. It's so ridiculously simple, it's crazy. If you look at some of the doggone equipment out there, from computer equipment to even the inverters that they use for solar panels, those things are generating a massive amount of heat. If you took that inverter and you built that inverter for the intention to take that waste heat off, you could use that doggone inverter for a heating system that would heat your water. And by doing that, you would ensure that that inverter, some of these doggone prices on these things, $300-$400 and higher, depending on how many watts you got coming off of this dang thing. But if you take that heat energy away from that thing fast enough, that thing would never fail. Nothing fails until it reaches its thermal breakdown. Once it reaches its thermal breakdown, that's when failure begins. So you could turn your AC inverters into heat supplies. You can use it to heat your water, you can use it to heat your house, You could take that heat energy and then turn it into thermal energy to run Peltier elements, thermal couples, thermal piles, and reuse that energy once again. So, looks like Muddy City is going to be home in 30 minutes. Cool. So anyway, basically what I'm trying to tell you folks is free energy is already here. It's already been here. Free electricity has been here since the dawn of time. To take everything is that is already in existence, to repurpose old electronics or whatever, to repurpose old knowledge from way back when, we have the capability using high voltage to replace every single nuclear power plant, every single coal-fired power plant, and end up with enough energy to do exactly what it is that we're doing now without the after effects of whatever toxins might be generated from utilizing what they call fossil fuels or radioactive rods or anything like that. No waste byproduct. All you're doing is taking what normally would have been wasted heat and turning it back into usable power. So we're going to generate heat in our circuitry on purpose. We're going to use what normally would have been trash electricity on purpose. And we're going to guide that energy to where we want it to go and get it to do what we want it to do. We want it to generate heat. We want it to be able to separate the water molecule into its two different states, hydrogen and oxygen. We can take that hydrogen and oxygen and turn it right back into yet even more power to run the equivalence of an internal combustion engine, or to run it in the equivalence of a fuel cell that will produce electricity as the hydrogen and oxygen are both separate and recombine in a condensing system. The same concepts would apply for filtering water purification, water heating, water treatment, fuel treatment. The whole key to everything that we've been talking about and what everybody's been fighting against throughout the entirety of the alternative energy and electrical free electricity communities or whatever, you got to get past heat, moisture, water, whatever, in order for the standard system to apply. I got in a fight some time back because I said I don't care about current watts and amps. I don't need current watts and amps to do what it is that I'm saying. And I wasn't saying that there wasn't none actually involved in the process of how you're going to get the electricity. What I was saying was, in this particular portion, your mathematics don't apply. And standard laws of physics, to some extent, don't even apply. I just decided to utilize the laws of physics to my advantage. I know that voltage is pressure. Pressure is what blows up a balloon. Pressure is what charges your battery. Pressure is what charges your capacitors. And you don't need a lot of current flow to do it. Static electricity from rubbing your carpet, your socks on the carpet, or your hair on a balloon is causing an imbalance, which in turn is causing pressure, which is high voltage. So we're just going to be pressurizing rapidly storage banks that when The Olympic-sized swimming pool is full. All the other systems underneath there will continue to run on demand. It's as simple as that. Ain't no hoodoo, voodoo version of plasma. Ain't no holy grail or unicorns involved. It is just taking every bit of science, mechanics, and physics and utilizing them to their maximum potential. That's what mad science is trying to bring to the world. High voltage heat and all the energies from any type of fuel you can possibly imagine is more than enough energy necessary to do all the work that we've been doing all along. Edison had DC current. Tesla had AC current. Both energies were one and the same. They just both had different delivery methods in order to get the work done. We knew that with DC current, we had fire potentials. Because not only at high voltages, DC had the capability of literally pressurizing itself until you walk past the light socket and it would blow your socks off. You get the crud shocked out of you because there was a lot of pressure buildup behind that circuit waiting for a path to ground. And that constant flow of energy through wires, if the wire couldn't handle the temperature, if the insulation couldn't handle the temperature, it would cause a thermal breakdown, which in turn would cause a fire. With AC current became a little bit more safe because you had a fluctuation. It wasn't a constant, until a certain frequency, it wasn't a constant temperature rise. And so you were less likely to reach your thermal breakdown before DC current. And at certain frequencies, the higher that it got, not even the insulation could hold the power back. That the high voltage wanted to find a path to ground and would burn right through the insulation. So both AC and DC current had their drawbacks. And now that we know that, now that we know differences in types of materials that won't reach a thermal breakdown or have an insulation factor like ceramic that won't conduct electricity and can even resist a lot of heat, we have the technology available to us to literally utilize both Edison and Tesla's version of energy, AC and DC current, to get work done in whatever fashion we choose. Even today, while we're on an AC current, we're still using Edison's DC version. And we have to find solutions how to jump back and forth between each one of them in the most efficient manner, such as the bridge rectifiers that we use to change high voltage AC into DC or whatever. Back and forth. And all it is changing of energy. Now that we have all this knowledge from Edison and Tesla of how they utilize this energy, we now know that we can take this energy and we can generate massive amounts of heat. We can separate the most stable water most stable molecule on Earth, which is water. We could separate it into two separate fuel sources. And in the process of doing that, also generate heat and electricity. So everything that we've been looking for in the alternative energy community has been right there all along. And this is what I've been shouting to all four points of the compass. Ain't no need sitting over there arguing over whose alternative energy device is the best. You know, this people are looking for zero point. They're looking for perpetual motion. They're looking for over unity, to get out more than you got, than you're putting in. We're not even trying to do that. We're just trying to utilize the laws of physics to the best of our ability. The oh god, where'd that go? 0 point, over unity, and perpetual motion. Perpetual motion, that's the one I was looking for. They say that perpetual motion is not possible. I don't care whether it is or isn't. Really, I don't. Even though I believe that perpetual motion is possible, I believe that perpetual motion is a terminology put out there to literally disprove anything regarding free energy. You can never get out more than you put in. They said that. There's losses in the system. Thermodynamics. They said that. And they said that it's not perpetual motion if you have an outside power source. Scree! Slam on the brakes! It's not perpetual motion if you have an outside power source. So what? Who cares? If I got a solar panel, and every time the sun is shining, and that electric motor stays running, and in the process of that electric motor staying running while the sun is shining, I'm storing energy into a battery bank that long after the sun stops shining, that electric motor stays running constant. And even in the process of that electric motor running, I'm grabbing the flyback energy off of that electric motor and storing it into a separate power bank at the same exact time. And so if a part of the day the sun is not shining, but I had utilized that part of the day to store enough energy into a second outside system that during the nighttime it would stay running constant, and then when the sun came up the next day it was still running. So if I have this system that is running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, I don't care whether you want to classify it as perpetual motion or not. All I care is that it hasn't stopped running. That's it. Because in the search for free energy, that's all we were trying to do to begin with, to get some work done. And so while this electric motor is running, I got a fan blade on it, and it's keeping me cool night and day, utilizing what they say is not perpetual motion, because it has an outside energy source, so it's not perpetual motion. Perpetual motion is a trap. Overunity is a trap. 0 point is a trap. Free energy is real. No ifs, ands, or buts. Free energy does exist. It is real. It does not defy any of the known laws of physics. It is 150,000% beyond a shadow of a doubt proven science. Now, when people want to get together and they want to utilize this proven science to actually make a benefit to the world and everybody that lives within and nature, I would be more than happy to join that dream team. If you're looking for over unity, if you're looking for 0 point, if you're looking for perpetual motion, then you have fell into the trap of the system that is charging you an energy bill. If you're looking for over unity, 0 point, perpetual motion, the unicorn, the Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the boogeyman, or the government to finally see their error of their evil deeds, then you don't belong on the dream team. Because you already fell into the trap. Perpetual motion is misnamed, and it has a set of rules. Otherwise, it's not perpetual motion. This Earth, according to their science, says that this Earth has been spinning around, and it has a moon that's spinning around it, and it has a sun that's, we're going around that as well, and we're flying through space, and it's been happening for billions of years, but yet perpetual motion doesn't exist, free energy doesn't exist. Well, if that is the truth, then your science is flawed. Whether it is a flat Earth or whatever, the waves are still moving. The wind is still blowing. There's heat coming from the sun. And there's energy coming from the earth. Energy is free. Your electric bill costs you money because you've been duped. It's as simple as that. And we want to use all that we have learned to produce all the free electricity that would produce all the heating and cooling and everything that we need to take care of all of mankind. Then we got to use what we've learned, this knowledge. We know that transistors get hot, so there's heat available there. We know why they get hot. We can intentionally create that circumstance to make them get hot. We can make a solid state heater that doesn't even require a pump, that will use thermal siphoning to circulate water through a radiator system and give you all the heat you needed. At the same time, the same system will produce a high voltage, high frequency that will light up LEDs, that will light up fluorescent bulbs, and it can be made on a table, in your garage, with very few tools, and recycled parts. People want a free energy device that they can measure. Well, there it is. Do the math once you get it. Math it up, scaled it up, scaled it down. Math, do the math, see what's what. If you pulse a magnetic field, you produce a waveform. Depending on how fast you pulse the magnetic field will determine on what type of waveform. So you can literally adjust this to run sine wave, square wave, triangle wave, whatever wave you want, it don't matter. That ought to get the electronics freaks all upset because I just said triangle wave. All we're doing is moving energy from one place to the next and changing it from one form to another, but it's all one and the same. Whether you're tapping the water, you're tapping the magnetic field, or you're utilizing the radiant energy from a heat source or whatever, you can take and modify existing equipment that already exists, and you can prove free energy once and for all. Everything out there that we have wastes more than we're putting in. Everything. If there was ever a case for over unity, the internal combustion engine would be that. Because like I said so many times, I pointed it out, that if you take one thing away from the internal combustion engine, it will literally generate enough energy to destroy itself. Parts will begin to fail according to their thermal breakdown. And when the weakest point of the chain fails, the whole thing stops. That's it. That's it in a nutshell. You can take a 2,500 watt generator and you can run your entire house. And if you wanted to be ingenuitive enough, I would say that you could run an entire town. And if you wanted to take it even further, I would say that you could run an entire city. And if you even want to get even more ridiculous about it, I would say that you could run an entire state. And then if you want to get even more ridiculous about it, I would say you could run an entire continent. And then if you just want to go completely off the scale, I would say you could run the entire planet off of a 2,500 watt generator. Once you tip the first domino, for every action is an equal and opposite reaction. And with all the elements that we have at our disposal and all the knowledge of the basic science that we have available to us and all the known laws of physics, when you fire that generator up and you're putting that gasoline to it, straight off the shelf, it's super inefficient. Modified to take that generator to its better efficiency, you change the delivery system of how that fuel is actually going into that generator. As the exhaust is coming out on your standard off-the-shelf generator, you are generating a massive amount of heat, whether it be a water-cooled or an air-cooled engine. That heat is even more energy that you can get effects from, such as something simple as run over there and touch the muffler with your bare finger. Psst. For every action is an equal and opposite reaction. Now you got this big, massive blister on your freaking finger. It was a stupid thing to do. The cylinders inside the internal combustion engine are generating friction, which is generating heat. So they have to be lubricated. The burn of the actual fuel in there, even though it's only burning a tiny percentage of the fuel introduced into the standard model, is producing heat as well. The heat is transferring through the walls and the bearings and the shafts of all the engine and is transferring down into the oil lubrication system and causing it to heat up as well. And everything's all right until it finally something in that system reaches its thermal breakdown and then begins to fail. But once you got the power source, such as a 2,500 watt generator, working as efficient as possible, and you send that energy out, and you utilize that energy to its maximum potential to cause and effect, you could send that energy all over the place, in so many different forms, to do whatever it is that you need to be done. You can transfer the energy through so many different types of materials that will give you so many different results. All we're doing is moving energy from one place to the next. If you had the most efficient power grid in the history of time, you would utilize the energy at whatever frequency range to generate whatever heat or lack thereof that you want. You can take the heat and turn it into cool. All the known laws of physics utilized specifically for efficiency, and all along that generator would never have to work hard. People think I'm crazy because they haven't tried. People think I'm crazy because I bucked the system and I'm standing outside the box telling them things that I do. It doesn't match the school book, so shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. Well, if I'm driving down a road in my automobile and my hose dry rotted as it is and finally decides to burst, spits all my coolant out the doggone hose. Suddenly the temperature in my engine begins to rise rapidly. I think I can make it home anyway. So I press on. Now that engine is like developing so much friction that it's generating so much doggone heat from the vibration of the engine running, from the combustion inside the cylinders. Every bit of heat is just adding up and building up and building up and building up, and finally the friction is overcoming and the doggone thermal breakdown has begun. The oil's viscosity changes. It gets thinner and thinner and thinner. The hotter that oil gets, it gets so thin that it begins to smoke. And at a certain point, the thermal breakdowns of the weakest part inside that engine begins to fail. The gaskets begin to melt off of the engine. The oil begins to leak up out of the side. Everything begins to start knocking because the pressure and the heat and everything is continuously building up until finally something's got to give. The metal on metal is now tearing the bearings apart, and eventually at some point they begin to weld themselves together. And finally, the engine comes to a screeching halt and the piston slams right through the side of the block. Now you tell me that ain't power. Tell me that ain't power. When you're driving down the road, your brakes are producing heat from the friction of the pads slipping across the rotors. If you're using old style drum brakes, it's just the same. As long as that temperature doesn't reach the thermal breakdown of the brake pad material, then your brake pads will slide smoothly across and not do any damage, except for the fact that depending on how smooth your rotor is, will begin to eat away at the material from every time you stop and the friction gets too high and it tears material off of the brake pad. If the brake pads never get to that point and the rotors are specifically maintained, they're going to last so much longer. If these parts will never reach their thermal breakdown to where they begin to fail, then your brakes will last for eternity. As you're driving down the road, your rotors are getting hot, your brake pads are getting hot. That heat is transferring from your rotors to your brake pads, to your doggone calipers, into the brake fluid that's inside the caliper. That heat is transferring all the way through the entire system into the bearings of the wheel itself, and it's raising the temperature of the grease up, which is lubricating the bearings so that they don't fail. You can follow the path of destruction from the thermal energy generated by all the processes for everything from electricity to mechanics and beyond. And if you can keep that heat energy going where you want it to go, just like the redneck hot tub, may take you a hair bit longer to get it started, but once you get it up, it takes nothing to maintain. It's as simple as that. I can sit here and explain in graphic detail how to build your free energy device, but it's up to you to do it. It's up to you to take these little nuggets that I've been putting out there for many years. I invested a lot of time and a lot of money, a lot of effort, blood, sweat, and tears into bringing Shaziz Radio to life for you. My YouTube channel, my Facebook channel, all of these are, and the Skype is all a way that we can interact with each other and get this information out. And I'm not asking anybody for anything. All I'm asking for people to do is to take these bits of information and at least try it before you deny it. If you take a transistor or a MOSFET and you turn that on, you switch it rapidly, and then you take the bare part of your thumb and you put it on the back of that transistor, you're going to burn a blister the size of Texas on the back of your thumb. That's fact. That energy can go somewhere. It did. It went right through your thumb, and it heated your thumb up to the extent where now your thumb is boiling, and it did physical damage to your thumb. Basically cooked your skin and heated up the water inside. Now, in order to keep those transistors cool, they put heat sinks on the back, and the temperature difference between the air around and the transistor itself seems to be enough for most cases to bring the temperature down, to take that heat away and put it into the atmosphere as opposed to leaving it in the transistor, and is enough to keep that transistor lasting longer. People who want them to last even longer take that same type of heat sink and put a water jacket in it as well to move that energy away from yet even faster. People who want to make it last yet even longer add a small fan that will blow air across the cooling fins of the heat sink in order to take that energy away yet even faster. So there's the stages right there that show you just with something as simple as a transistor, you can generate a massive amount of heat. Heat energy is one of the most powerful and destructive elements in existence. Heat can be your worst enemy, or it can be your best friend. Now, one of the things that we've been trying to figure out is how to keep people warm during the winter time to where they can afford to do it. And in order to be able to keep them warm and not cause a fire in the house, we got to be careful about how we move that energy around. Because the oil-filled, resistive load-style heating system has failure points that can literally cause this thing to overpressurize, burn, and set fire to things around with flaming oil. But we have the technology to build the perfect space heater and have that space heater be able to literally produce the heat that will keep you warm and keep the lights on. And all of that thermal energy generated by that is not going to waste. It's being utilized in some other fashion for warming your water up so that you can at least take a warm shower or a hot shower or whatever. Most generally, you're not taking the shower at 180 degrees anyway from whatever your hot water heater is, 100 and some odd degrees temperature. You keep it up there, and a lot of that energy is wasted. Body's 98.6 degrees, so if you can generate 98.6 degree water, then you can keep somebody at body temperature comfortable while they take a shower. So you don't need to have all that energy being charging up your hot water heater. You just need the energy enough to keep it to the extent to where it's comfortable for you to take a shower. I'm telling you, folks, if we utilized energy properly, you could run your house, your continent, the entire world off the equivalence of a 2,500 watt generator. Now, that makes me sound crazy. It makes me sound ridiculous because it doesn't match what the school book said. For every 100 watt incandescent light bulb with a tungsten element, you have a resistive load. How many LEDs can you light with the equivalence of the power that it takes to light 100 watt incandescent light bulb? And the equivalence of lumens that are actually produced by certain versions of LEDs as opposed to the equivalence of lumens actually produced by the 100 watt incandescent light bulb. LEDs don't require a lot of current flow. Matter of fact, too much current flow will actually burn them out rapidly. That's why you have to put a transistor, resistor, so that you don't get no sudden surge in power, and you don't burn it out. So we know we got our lighting resolved, and we can energize this energy instead of utilizing it in the same fashion that we've utilized it before. We're now taking this energy and we're focusing it and doing what we want it to be done with it. We're getting ourselves light. Our light bill is less now because we're utilizing the best materials to do the job that require the least amount of input as far as wattage and amperage and such. And we're taking what would have normally been an obnoxious deal to produce heat. I find this so doggone frustrating. Because right now, if you've got an old computer or you got an old TV or whatever, you're sitting there with the holy grail of free parts. And with that said, a little bit of knowledge. A little bit of basic science. And you can do what you did before, utilizing what would have normally been trash to give you light, heat, fresh water. That's another thing about heat and water, is you can boil water and you can turn it into steam, which you can turn into pressure, which you then in turn can release that pressure into an expansion chamber and turn it into cool, which will cause the water to condense and then come out the other side, leaving all the impurities behind. So you can boil water, turn it into steam, and then turn it into fresh water on the opposite side, leaving behind all the heavy metals and crud, and killing off all the biological and so on. And then one step further, using as the gravity flows the water down the other side, a filtration system that would take out all whatever's left over. Everything needed to do exactly what I'm talking about, you can find in the dump. Because when people's electronics break down, the first thing they do is throw it in the trash. Because in this throwaway society that we live in today, it's cheaper to go out and buy a new one than it is to pay a man to fix the old one. Which is pure ridiculousness. And companies like the ones that make the Beckett oil burner igniter, they don't want you to know what's inside of them or how they function. So they fill them in with a black epoxy or tar or whatever, so that if there's any kind of attempt for you to take that tar off there to see the circuit, you cannot reverse engineer that circuit. That way that you can't figure out that using something like Ludic Science just showed you in these three videos that he had, that you can replicate the Beckett oil burner igniter using junk recycled from the trash. So instead of going out and buying a high voltage power supply, you could literally salvage, reclaim, repurpose some old stuff to build a high voltage power supply and not pay them $85 per unit to do so. But nonetheless, this information's out there, and if you were to utilize just the knowledge in these three videos alone and then scroll down and check out the technology for the magnetron, which is a microwave oven magnetron, and then go down yet even further and find the deal for the starter generating system, you could utilize these bits of knowledge to literally build the perfect free energy device. No ifs, ands, or buts. And as long as you don't call it perpetual motion and you add an outside source to it, you just if you fall into the perpetual motion over unity, 0 point, and all this different crazy terminology that science and the establishment and the patent office and all them basically use as a trap to reject people from being able to give what Tesla tried to do back in the day to the world, then I don't know what to say. When you talk about Tesla technology and wireless energy, and people say, well, you can't run your house off of wireless energy, that's because they don't understand and they don't know how. I've just explained to you how. Go into the world of thermoelectrics and look up thermal exchangers, thermal couples, thermal piles, Peltier elements, and you know how you can turn heat back into usable electricity. Pay attention to what I said about heating water with a high voltage arc. See, the Beckett oil burner igniter was capable of producing 10,000 volts per leg to a maximum of 20,000 volts coming out. But when I plugged the ground into the earth, that was amplified. And so you can literally boil water using 12 volt battery. You know, heck, you could do that with just induction heating alone. So with just a high frequency, high voltage you can take the most stable molecule in the world and you can get it hot. You can get it so hot that it flashes the steam. You can get it so hot that you can pressurize that to superheated steam. And you can get that pressure and that heat so hot that you literally get the equivalence of what happened in Fukushima during the meltdown. See, people don't understand what was going on there. You didn't have a nuclear explosion. You had a hydrogen explosion. A compression ignition that literally pressurized and overpressurized and ignited the hydrogen and oxygen and created a massive boom. The radiation contamination that would occur if this was to be inside the part that holds all the radioactive material would be the initial problem until you was able to clean it up. So there's a lot of misunderstandings on what actually occurred or what actually does occur during a nuclear meltdown of a power plant. Thermal breakdown, pressures causing the hydrogen explosion, which makes a mess. I'm telling you that utilizing technology such as high voltage instead of radioactive rods or coal-fired power plants, you could do the equivalence of what a hydroelectric dam does right in front of your face. The guys who own the hydroelectric dams are probably the smartest people that ever lived. Because what they have done is tapped into what nature has already supplied, and they are making energy that they are getting for free and selling to you. Man, I don't know what more to say. Anybody out there wants to work on some cool stuff, give me a holler. Anybody out there wants to try to take science to its next level to benefit all of mankind, give me a holler. Anybody wants to try to figure out the best ways and the most efficient ways to run engines, electrical appliances, and do it without paying the man, give me a holler. Anybody wants to put together the dream team of the most brilliant minds in the history of time to resolve all the issues of the so-called energy crisis that does not exist, the so-called climate change, climate disruption, or global warming that, whatever, give me a holler. If you want to talk about real science, if you want to talk about real solutions, then ShazizRadio.com is the place for you. People say, you're too political. Might even say I'm too, they like to use the word religious, but I'm not. But nonetheless, they get frustrated. Because they don't think anything's being done or said. There's a phrase out there, somebody said, those that can't teach. So maybe to some extent that's what I'm doing, I'm teaching, because I ain't got the resources or the skill set to build the devices that I see inside my brain. I need somebody with some talent. I need somebody willing to build. I need somebody willing to help me do some work without arguing with me over why it is that they think it ain't possible. That's the whole resource right there. That's the whole holy grail, is to getting everybody and his brother to work together. pulling your resources together and actually making things that really function. That's it. It's that doggone simple. Share these podcasts with people out there. Bring them here. You're going to get the wise guys that's going to come here and call me everything under the sun. I heard you said you could run an entire planet with a 2,500 watt generator. Well, sure you could. Because you could take that 25 watt generator and start a doggone domino effect across the doggone planet with all the different types of elements and electrical piezoelectric crystals in the earth and everything under the doggone sun. Imagine what would happen if you put a high frequency, high voltage that matched the resonancy of the doggone crystals that are in the caves down underneath the earth. If you send a high frequency wave into a cave full of quartz crystals, piezoelectric crystals, with iron and water tables, you could cause those piezoelectric crystals to vibrate to literally turn that entire cave system into the hugest base cannon in the history of time. And suddenly people would be hearing apocalyptic sounds heard around the earth. And keep in mind, we only started off with a 2,500 watt generator doing that. And we took that same 2,500 watt generator after we sent our high frequency signal down through the water table and in through all the caves and created this loud rumbling sound that everybody on the planet thought was apocalyptic sounds heard around the earth. And we could develop another frequency wave that we could literally cause things to vibrate so rapidly that they would in turn produce friction, which in turn would produce heat and start a fire. We could take those same doggone vibrations and cause things to vibrate to the extent where this little rock that was holding up that little rock vibrates out of place and literally creates an earthquake. And we could take that same high frequency and we can energize the dipole molecule in water and create the water to literally separate, and as the high frequency wave continues to come in, ignite it on demand. The earth is 3/4 covered in water. That is a whole lot of power. There's hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen in the air that, if properly energized, could literally ignite the entire atmosphere. We could start a domino effect with the frequency ranges that we could generate from a 2,500 watt generator that would start earthquakes, fires, explosions, loud apocalyptic sounds being heard around the earth. It's not the amount of energy that you have available to you. It's the way that you utilize that energy. It's as simple as that. You know, some folks who believe that free energy is not possible believe in a concept called the butterfly effect. They believe that by one little tiny action, one positive pebble in the pond, you send ripples out that affect the entirety of the pond. By one little action, you create some sort of domino effect that goes around the entire world. And knowing the basic science of water, knowing the basic sciences of gas, knowing the heating, expansion, contraction, everything that has to do with pressure, voltage, water, knowing all this stuff right here, once that first domino tips from the right device, the frequency ranges are infinite. You understand what it is that I'm trying to say? I hope so. Because mankind has been duped. They've been screwed. They've been literally lied to and enslaved. Energy is free. And the things that you can do if you know how to utilize frequency ranges, will blow your mind. The things that you can see, the temperatures that you can create. I've seen things in my lab that physics told me was not even remotely possible. Yet I'm insane. I said something crazy. I'm going to take a 2,500 watt generator and produce enough electricity to run the entire globe. Produce enough energy. And that makes me insane. It's not the amount of power. It's the resources and the knowledge of the science of what each of them will do under which circumstances that would produce enough power. If I started a fire using high frequency, how many BTUs will that fire consume before the process stops? So I took my 2,500 watt generator and I started a forest fire. How many BTUs is in that forest fire? How much energy will that produce? They're saying, well, starting a forest fire, that ain't usable electricity. That ain't usable energy. Really? You got a lot of heat going on there. You can at least warm your biscuits with it. You can boil water with it. You can get rid of your burn piles, your trash with it. You can generate a lot of light with it. That's a whole lot of energy from a 2,500 watt generator. And I could even take it even farther. I don't even need a 2,500 watt generator to start a forest fire. I could use a match. But there's a lot of energy involved in there. And if you understand what happened from start to finish, you understand how that massive amount of energy was released with something as simple as a spark. That's why I get so incredibly frustrated when people try to tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about and I don't understand energy or how it travels. Because I just explained to you in graphic detail how you can get millions of BTUs by starting a forest fire. With that 2,500 watt generator, I just use that for an example because you could run your entire house off a 2,500 watt generator if you had a storage facility capable of holding back the pressure that this thing is capable of generating. All of the electronic appliances that we use have a magnetic field that expands past the transformer. It uses more. It wastes more energy than it actually uses. Just by making it efficient, making that doggone thing run to its maximum efficiency, you'll get more efficiency out of that generator. And I can go back and forth about all the different things that's occurring while this generator is actually running. The wasted heat, the friction, the way that it'll tear itself apart, and blah blah, back and forth. But until I get enough people on a dream team that are willing to understand that these forces could actually be monopolized on, man, just gonna keep on doing what we do. Pay the man. It's that simple. Pay the man. Pay your water bill. Pay your light bill. Pay your electric bill. Pay your gas bill for your car. Or take all the bits of science and knowledge that have been put down there on the table through all the researchers that have ever came before us and utilize them to their maximum potential and generate the holy grail of free energy devices. A 300 watt, 400 watt, 500 watt, 600 watt, all the way up to a couple thousand watt inverter will generate enough heat that it will fry itself out when it gets too hot. So if you want that inverter to last longer, then keep it cool. Instead of going out and paying anywhere from a couple hundred to a couple thousand dollars for whatever wattage inverter that you need, figure out a way to keep it cool. Figure out a way to make a cigarette lighter that won't run out of fuel. Rechargeable hydrogen lighter, or even oxygen for that matter. There's more power available to humanity than we could ever use in a trillion, 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 and to infinity and beyond. And yet we've let science and governments and power companies and the system basically tell us that it's not possible. There are electronics and electrical engineers that come out of college that will argue with me until they are blue in the face. They'll get mad and stomp away. Because I will not submit to their laws of physics. I will not submit to their education. I will not submit to the system's lie. That energy is not free. If you know the result of a specific action, an anomaly that will occur, you can monopolize on that result. You know that if you blow up a balloon, that you can pressurize that balloon and that balloon will expand. And you can hand that balloon to a child and they will have joy from that balloon. Because it's cool. And then you know that if somebody else decides to be a wise guy and pops that balloon with the pin, that instantaneous release will cause an acoustic wave that will scare the crud out of same said child and cause a result. You also know that if while you're blowing that balloon up, if you overpressurize that balloon, it will blow up in your face. You also know that if you're blowing up that balloon and for some reason it gets away from you and that pressure releases through a nozzle into that before you actually got a chance to tie it off, that the balloon will fly around the air back and forth until its energy disperses completely out. So we know how to produce a magnetic field, we know how to shut it off, turn it on, shut it off, turn it on, shut it off, and we know that by doing this, we produce a high voltage, we can induce a current, we can get electrons to flow, and we can produce electricity. But the naysayers and the wise guys say old Shaziz don't know what the heck he's talking about. I said that I don't care about current watts and amps. And I started a fight. I wonder. Let me see if Muddy's in here. So, what are you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm at the last 15 minutes of the show. I've already created a ruckus. And so, I'm having a good day.
Jordan started a ruckus, huh?
Oh, yeah. See, I said a lot of crazy stuff throughout the years. Told people I didn't care about current Watson amps. I started a fight. People just like got all upset about that. They got up on their ear because they didn't understand what it was I was actually trying to say.
And you didn't care about what people said physics actually have, because sometimes physics is not even right.
That's right. Well, see, here's the thing, man. I said that there's enough power in a 2,500 watt generator to run everyone's house on this globe. That sounds like the biggest hockahooey in the history of hockahooeys, because, you know, there ain't enough water. It's just not even possible to do that. But wait a second. Wait a second. The energy that I started off with, let's say I just had nothing more than a piece of flint. All right? And I went out in the, I went out in the woods, and I took that piece of flint, and I sparked it down on a piece of dry grass, and then started off a fire that engulfed an entire forest. How many BTUs is available there?
Quite a bit.
Yeah, I just started a domino effect. I started a runaway fire. There's a heck of a lot of energy potential came just from that one action. And so when you talk about using energy, it's not that we don't have enough energy. It's how we use the energy. We're just moving it from one point to the next and changing whatever form of energy we need at the time. So if I took a 2,500 watt generator, how many LEDs could I light up with 2,500 watts?
I don't know. How many watts are in the vein of a coffee cup? You know, that little handle.
Yeah? It's hard to say.
Yep, it's enough energy in that, in the handle of that coffee cup to evaporate the world's oceans.
Well, see, that's the whole thing. All you need is to have basic knowledge of science, to understand that for every action they say is an equal and opposite reaction. And so if I'm able to ignite a massive amount of oxygen, then I get a massive result. If I'm able to separate the water molecule, which is supposedly the most stable molecule on the earth, if I separate it into its two separate components and I ignite that, then I get yet an even more in two different direction result. Am I wrong?
Of course you're wrong, to the right people.
Well, yeah, if you talk to the trolls and the college-educated electronics engineers. Sure. Look, I started a fight because when I said that I didn't care about current watts and amps, and they're all like, well, you can't do without no current watts and amps. And I was like, you know, look, here's the thing. The amount of amperage and the amount of wattage necessary for me to run a Beckett oil burner igniter is insignificant to the grand scheme of things, because I'm just taking that high frequency, high energy, and I'm transferring it into something completely different. So your math at that point doesn't apply. After I've left the oil burner igniter, the oil burner igniter will consume so much energy. All right? And unless I do something different, that's all it's going to consume. And I just took that energy and I transferred it into something else, and I got a couple different results. I got visible light. I got heat out of the deal. I energized gas into the fourth state of matter. I got three results so far to one. I was able to take in and by the input of whatever gap I have on my spark gap to be able to change the frequency range of that energy and produce a radiant energy as well. So I started off a domino effect with that oil burner igniter. It's only going to consume what it normally consumes. There was no lens effect that was invoked at that point in time. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Now, because of the way the oil burner igniter was actually designed, there were eddy currents involved and resistance involved that generated heat within that deal, and so there was waste going on inside the deal, that if it got to a certain point and that material reached its thermal breakdown, the Beckett oil burner igniter would fail. It would get too hot. Transistors or MOSFETs, whichever ones they use in there, would burn up, and now I got an $85 piece of junk. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
But at no time did I ever use more energy than that thing would normally consume. But in the process, I turned that energy to what I wanted it. I guided the energy to where I wanted it. And so, with a 2,500 watt system, how many doggone Beckett oil burn igniters could I have destroyed? All in one, you know, in one deal.
All of them.
Yeah. And there are easier, simpler methods to generate high voltage that will not allow the transistors, the MOSFETs, or whatever that you got to reach its thermal breakdown and fail. If there was a way that I could have got those people who built that Beckett oil burner igniter to engineer it to the extent where it was actually water cooled and air cooled at the same exact time, and there was no potential for that transistor to ever reach its thermal breakdown, that thing would last forever. As long as I was utilizing...
You were talking about the water-cooled heat sinks.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So if they had a water-cooled heat sink built into that same device, I wouldn't have burned up an $85 part. And I would have actually been willing to buy it for more from the factory than I paid for the first one because of the fact that I knew it would hold up. See, they call them constant-duty supplies, but if you run them at constant duties, if they get too hot, they will burn up and they will fail. So you could run it for maybe a couple hours and then you'd have to shut it off and let it cool down. But
yeah, that's when you turn the other one on.
Yeah. But if you had two of them, like you just said, and you could alternate them back and forth and still produce 20,000 volts of pressure, you could do a lot of work with that.
Or you could piggyback them.
Yeah. Yep. So... when I say stuff like I don't care about current watts or amps, or you could run the entire planet off of one 2,500 watt generator, that's mostly to get everyone out there riled up to actually thinking about, hey, is he right? Could you really do that? Yeah, you could start a domino effect that would release enough energy from that dang generator, radio waves that would cause other radio waves that would cause, think about this for a second, buddy.
Ripples causing other frequencies.
Yeah.
Of ripples.
Imagine if I'm generating a frequency with a frequency generator that matches the resonance of a piezoelectric crystal. And that piezoelectric crystal is encrusted in this big, huge cave system. So I vibrate these piezoelectric crystals, and those vibrations resonate in the form of acoustic waves through this cave system. And now suddenly, everyone on the planet is hearing these apocalyptic sounds heard around the world. Right? I just created a massive bass cannon using basic science. When I first saw one of those videos, I typed in, if anybody wants to research some of my comments from the past, I'm begging you. Go back into the past to find all these videos that say apocalyptic sounds heard around the world, and look, scroll down and see if Oshaziz ever commented on those videos. And you'll find that on many of these videos I comment, I know exactly what that sound is, but I am not saying.
Nope.
And I'll just leave it there. But if you think about how a little earbud that you put in your ear, or how a little microphone that has a piezoelectric crystal works, and then you think about nature, and you think about a cave system, how much better of a bass cannon can you get just by knowing the resonant frequency of quartz crystal? Piezoelectric crystal.
Talking about resonance and bass cannons, I mean, you're talking audio.
Yeah.
Now, you go back... Yeah, I do remember. It was talking about in one of the pyramids, they got this chamber in there where you go, and it's got this stepped resonant chamber to make several other frequencies out of it, and it gets louder and louder and louder, and that there is proof of audio.
That's right. That's right. And look, here's
sound like 100 people all going, ah.
Here's the thing.
In harmony in different frequencies.
The military and the police figured out how to use radio frequencies and acoustic waves to make it uncomfortable so you didn't want to riot or protest or fight. Now, isn't that not energy whenever they can send an acoustic or a sonic wave from a machine to your body, multiple bodies for that matter, and cause right. them to want to not be there? So the energy that we're producing from our 2,500 watt generator is making an annoying sound that is vibrating off the windows, causing the windows to rattle to the extent where they finally shatter. How much acoustic wave power is involved in that?
You don't need much. You just got to have the right frequency.
That's right. So basically when I say something like, you can take a 2,500 watt generator and produce enough energy to produce enough power to run every single light bulb and electronics appliance in this world, it's scientifically backed by fact. You start a forest fire, count up the BTUs. You start a hydrogen explosion, count up the pressure. Steam, it don't matter. And it's not how much energy you have, it's how you use it.
Pretty much.
Tesla figured out that if you took a knife switch and you flipped it rapidly, you could ramp the voltage up on something to the extreme. And many of you inadvertently witnessed that when you went into the bathroom and turned the light on too quickly because you was in a hurry and that sudden surge blew your light bulb out, and so now you're in the dark.
You know what car normally gets around 30 miles to the gallon? Now, this is nighttime with the headlights on. I decided I'd put $5 worth of gas in the car and go do the route. And I set the cruise control while going down this highway. It's basically 55. I set the cruise control at 35 because that's bare minimum speed limit. And I figured I'd get all my papers rolled on the way. I was rolling my papers. And on this 2003 Honda Civic Hybrid, you're supposed to get up to 48 miles per gallon, but the batteries, they're old. Nickel metal hydrides only last up to 8-10 years, and then you got to replace them, and it's a couple thousand dollars worth of nickel metal hydride D-cell batteries that go in these stacks and everything. So I just said, well, if I knock the wind resistance down, seeing as like if I had a 5-foot prop and then I had a 10-mile-an-hour wind, I'd have so much energy available for that prop to absorb. If the wind speed doubled, I'd have 8 times that power. So if I slowed my vehicle down to 35 miles per hour, and I'm in the top gear, I wondered what the mileage would be. When I got to the gate, I was looking at that little mileage thing there that fluctuates as I drive, and totals up the average. I got 58 miles to the gallon by the time I got to the gate of Pecan Plantation. And that slowly diminished as I threw the rest of the route. I tried not to. I step on the brake, it charges the batteries, and then when I step on the gas, it uses it right back up. And if you do that, immediately afterward, it doesn't have time for the batteries to lose, so it stays pretty much in efficiency. And I did the route as smooth as I could. I wound up at the end with 38 miles per gallon instead of my normal 30 by my normal driving. So it's like you said, that's how you use that energy, pretty much. But I thought that was a pretty good example.
Yeah, it is. and that efficiency could.
But I was looking at 58 miles per gallon.
That efficiency could go up yet even higher with a few supplemental systems. Imagine if you had solar on the top of that, or you had wind turbines, or even generators through the wheels and stuff. You could. at the very least, increase the efficiency.
I thought it was great. Well, I almost doubled. If I could cruise to your house from my house at 35 miles per hour and had the time and didn't get bored, gosh, man, I could do it with the gas on one way.
Yeah. That's the whole thing, man. What I've been saying here, it doesn't defy any of the laws of physics. It just uses everything to your advantage. And the reason why I continuously talk about high voltage is because when you got high voltage, you got a lot of pressure. And you have a lot of heat potential. I got a blister on two of my fingers from touching a spark gap after I shut the power off. It had generated enough heat inside that spark gap to literally burn my fingers when I touched it. Right? That was residual energy left over from the process of that spark going across there.
Right.
And so if I wanted to utilize this force that just burnt my finger for a positive deal, I'd figure out a way to design a microwave magnetron to take that spark gap and put it inside the magnetron, which would make it inside the vacuum and do exactly what the magnetron used to do with the resistive load that it had. But now it is generating the heat necessary to release the electrons using nothing more than the plasma arc spark that's going across inside that deal. Those released electrons within that magnetic field would create a rotation, and that rotation of those electrons would get trapped up into the guidance system inside of that magnetron, causing to spin yet even faster and sending that energy in the form of a wave out the antenna of the microwave. And I would be able to take the most stable water, stable molecule, which is water, and vibrate that water to the extent where I could separate those water molecules with a radio frequency and create friction, which in turn create heat, and at some point, if you kept the process going, would actually create ignition. And it all started off with a concept from running a 12 volt Beckett oil burner igniter, shooting that energy through. Normally with just the igniter itself, you'll get a pretty decent arc. But the moment you plug that doggone thing down into the earth ground, you'll watch that arc as it amplifies. So I'm putting, instead of the normal 2,000 volts or thereabout that they use for the average magnetron, I'm putting 10,000 volts to this thing. And I got enough heat and pressure inside there. Huh?
There's more over unity in that when you raise that voltage.
Yeah. And so,
the higher the voltage, the more fun things happen.
Yeah. So instead of using whatever your average microwave is, whatever wattage your average microwave is, I started off with a 12-volt car battery and was able to do the same exact job. It's about how you move the energy.
That same one, is that same 12-volt car battery? It only does 10 volts because it's so old and you've had for like 10 years?
Yeah. It's a turkey. You couldn't start your car with it. You couldn't start your car with it. Well, that's the thing, man. No matter how much energy that you have, it matters what you do with the energy that you got. And all this different things that we've got around here, if I can find somebody who would humor me long enough to build to my specification just exactly what I'm saying, I'll prove it to you. All we need for a tabletop free energy device, at the very least, it's going to be called super efficient. It's some transistors or MOSFETs, whichever ones are readily available, some water-cooled heat sink, and, you know, a couple containers, and I'll show you how to heat and circulate water without no electric pump, be able to light up a massive string of LEDs or even fluorescent bulbs, generate light and heat using a solid state circuit that, if properly designed, would replace every single resistive space heater element on the globe. Or flat earth, whichever one you believe. No matter to me.
Oh, did you see my solar oven video?
No, but I'll have to take a peek at it.
Yeah, I took, got one of these, Nutrisystem styrofoam coolers. Pretty good size, about the size of one of them, tabletop refrigerators. Good size, you know, probably about, I'd say about, 15 or 20 gallon. And the foam on that thing is 3 inches thick. 3 inches thick. A lot thicker than 1 inch or slightly under 1 inch foam coolers that you get. And I had a 55 watt solar panel. And I figured I had one of them ceramic light fixtures, and I mounted that down at the bottom of the doggone thing. And I kind of stood it up like a refrigerator. And I took a 50 watt 12 volt bulb. I figured the solar panel jumps up to 22 or 24 volts open voltage. So if I've got a bulb that matches the wattage of the solar panel, then it should go to down to half or to the voltage that it should be, so I wouldn't wind up blowing my bulb.
Yep.
So I put the 50 watt bulb down in the bottom of that bad boy, and then I stuck a piece of copper coat hanger or copper wire through there and a couple holes in the top of a soup can there. I stuck all my hot dogs in the soup can and run that wire straight across there and set it about 1 inch above the bulb. And then I closed the lid and I let the sun shine. The bottom of them doggone hot dogs got sizzly. You know, they kind of get that overcooked wonderful taste where the grease actually gets cooked and they sizzle for a bit.
Yeah.
And the rest of it, just the tops of them hot dogs just kind of burst apart. But I didn't show that on the video because I didn't have time for editing and splicing two videos together. But I tell you what, them are some good hot dogs. Solar cooked hot dogs. Talk about a solar oven.
Yeah, and you with that cooler and all the different things that you use the sun to your advantage, and you directed the heat instead of the heat dispersing out into the atmosphere. You kept it contained inside that cooler, which kept it contained inside the can where you cooked your hot dogs. So
yeah, the thing is, see, your solar panel takes up a little bit more room than what that cooler would have, right? And I put it on the roof of this pallet shop I just built. And the cool thing is there, see, if I'm taking the sun's energy off a part of my roof, then that cools it off in here a little bit more. And I put that heat inside the box.
Yep.
I redirected that hot energy through different means, transformation, into my little box.
That's what I'm saying.
I enjoyed that, and I had another one up there running my fan to keep me cool.
If you wanted to, you could take the design that you just talked about, and we're going to have to speed this up because we're over time, but if you wanted to, you could take...
You own the station. I don't want to hear that.
Yeah, you could take the time. If you take the time, let's say you go out and buy you one of them big plastic igloo coolers that's pretty well insulated. And then you went out and you bought you some concrete...
Get those plastic ones. They warp.
Yeah, well, I'm going to show you how to make it not warp. Anyway, you take one of them plastic coolers, and inside there, you take and build you a firebox, the equivalence of a firebox like you'd have in, you know, some of the different wood-burning stoves. And then you did pretty much the same system with lighting that, you know, a halogen light. You wouldn't even need very much. Whatever solar panel that you have that could actually run that light bulb, that's all you need. All right, now you take on the lid of the cooler, you put a solar panel, whatever 40 watt small size 12 volt solar panel that will run a halogen bulb. You could turn that doggone cooler into an electric oven that all you had to do was set out in the sun, and the sunlight beating down on top of that would, you know, cook your food inside of that cooler. Just like what you're talking about, But that would be a marketable device that you could sell to campers and survivalists, because you would actually have a on-demand furnace. You bake a cake in the doggone thing. Look at them easy bake ovens. They only use a 100-watt light bulb in them doggone things.
Yeah, that's basically what it was. Now people say, oh, you took the idea from the easy bake oven. No, I didn't. I took the idea from a hot box. That's where easy bake oven got their idea, because people used to make hot boxes to cook, heat their lunch up there, and about break time, and then lunchtime they'd eat.
Yeah.
And then Easy Bake went over to it, but just because that's what they know, they figure, oh, well, you took it from the, no. This is what I figure if I charge it from the sun, I call it my solar oven. Who needs a bunch of reflectors and happen to go out there every 10 minutes to adjust the reflective panels? I'll tell you what, I opened that thing up, man, steam fogged my glasses. It didn't fog my camera. I thought it did when I looked at it. I didn't show that video, but yeah, it fogged my glasses real good.
Well, post a link of that video into the chat room if you get a chance. That way I can take a peek at it, or I'll have to hunt it down later. But nonetheless, taking all the things that we already have available to us, and understanding science and physics and all that kind of stuff, there is no reason why we couldn't do some amazing things with the power that we have available to us. And this process that you just got to explain, it's a brilliant process, because you could do so much with that. You know, you could make a solar-powered oven where you can cook, make cakes and biscuits or whatever in it, or you could even turn that power into the equivalence of a barbecue grill, because that heat rises and you have a copper plate over the top of that doggone light bulb. That heat's going to transfer through that copper and you can cook on it.
Yeah, it's going to spread it out. I tell you what, it got hot inside that sucker because it did not let the heat out. Now, I'm thinking about putting a second solar panel and another 50-watt bulb. One of the hot boxes I built on the job while doing the drywall, we put a 75-watt and a 50-watt, and the lid started warping, and the guy that the supervisor of the place there, he complained. He said, yeah, I don't need no fires here. So we unscrewed one of the bulbs. We unscrewed the 75-watt, and we found out that the 50-watt bulb was good enough. And it was a bigger hot box than the one we got, than the one I'm playing with. But I figured, shoot, I could put two in there, and I could line the inside with the foil. And if you line the inside with the foil, guess what? That means no oxygen can touch any burnable surface, so therefore it will not get oxygen, it will not burn. So the main thing there is, my ultimate goal is to bake a cake.
Yeah.
Or at least some cupcakes.
You know what I say? You could actually...
I'm thinking of throwing a whole dog. I'm thinking of maybe throw some ribs in that bad boy.
You know what I say you could also do if you really wanted to take the time to do so? Is you could take the element out of a coffee pot and not even use the electrical portion, just... basically mounted underneath the metal that you're going to be cooking on, and use that heat transfer
put it above the bulb and make some coffee.
Yeah, make some coffee while you cook your breakfast.
That's right.
Look, folks, you've just heard a couple...
as long as I keep it inside there, inside the oven, then that energy is not escaped. And
that's
the temperature of the oven doesn't go down. Yeah, I could make my morning tea along with that.
Huh? That's right. You could invent a perfect cooler that would be utilized to basically a solar-powered breakfast cooking system that would cook your coffee, cook your eggs and your toast and everything under the sun using the sun.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that an incandescent bulb is actually a heat source with a byproduct of light.
Yeah.
90% of it goes off as heat.
Yeah.
It's not very efficient at all, but that's the wonderful thing about it.
So, anyway, utilizing that bit of knowledge right there, we just showed you a little tiny example of what we have to offer here at ShazizRadio.com. Ideas. All right? And ideas, it don't matter where they came from. It don't matter who we borrowed the idea from. We know the idea works, and we are able to utilize that idea to do actual work. And so if you bring your ideas to the table and we got our ideas to the table, we essentially have what I've been looking for all along as the dream team, and we can take them ideas and expand on them. There's more than enough energy.
You keep saying that word idea, and you're going to have Boomer calling in here talking about the way you pronounce it.
Yeah. Well, see that? There's over unity because some of the things that come out of my mouth start a riot.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, folks, you've been listening.
Can you hear me? Give my creation flight!
Aw, crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.